Hello, my name's Eugene Ellis. I'm a psychotherapist and founder of the Black and Asian Therapist Network, also known as BARTN. These podcasts, as ever, are a continuing conversation around the psychological life of Black and Asian people in the UK. Today, I'm in conversation with Sanjay Joban Putra, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Westminster. He has worked in a number of community-based projects as an Asian drug worker, alcohol advisory worker, and HIV/AIDS social worker. Within the context of identity politics and developing a voice in this area, his PhD explored the experiences of Black and minority ethnic students studying psychology in higher education. His research has continued for over 20 years and contributed to changes in the content of psychology courses currently taught at his university. Here is Sanjay Joban Putra. So, welcome, Sanjay, to the Black and Asian Therapist Network podcast. I'm in your offices here. Before we get into some of your research and some of your ideas more fully, can you say a little bit about what's made you choose psychology and what's been your journey into the profession?
Thanks, Eugene. Coming into psychology, it was really quite a chance happening and a happening that I'm very grateful about. It all started when I was studying some A-levels at college. I was doing biology, sociology, and history. About 3 months into those A-levels, I realized that I was enjoying biology less and less, and I was getting more and more detached in the class, in those biology classes, and I thought I can't carry on with this. So I approached my sociology teacher, who also taught psychology.
I mean, what was it about psychology that was calling you to kind of continue into be a psychologist?
Yeah, the actual subject matter, the focus on human behavior, on human experience, just learning about all sorts of different aspects about life, really, about human interactions, getting insights into why we do the things that we do. For instance, there is the classic Milgram study, which explored the factors that cause people to behave in extreme ways simply because they are told to do so by figures of authority.
Right.
You know, so that was a very good example of very novel insight, if you like, that psychology was able to produce. It felt almost like a religion to me, in that it provided an all-encompassing framework, not only for understanding behavior in general, but also I felt for the first time it started to give me some understanding about myself, self-knowledge, knowledge of the self, self-discovery. So that was, in a sense, my conscious journey, or the first stage of my conscious journey.
Right.
So it played a huge, huge role in that respect.
Yeah. And there's something about the insights that you found in psychology which kind of dovetailed with your own experience to some extent, I guess. And sort of created some answers for you.
No, I think that's a really valid point. Yes, I think that is what it did. It echoed certain questions within me, which I had been entertaining anyhow. And I think those questions themselves were probably fueled by my own upbringing, being brought up within a spiritual background where the emphasis is always on, you know, looking at yourself, on exploring the sense of self, on things like serving others and how you can grow through your relationships with others.
Yes.
So it was those kinds of general spiritual questions which then were complemented by the psychological framework that I embarked on.
Right.
Yeah. So then I went to university. It was such a wonderful opportunity to really immerse myself in this process, to be given the license for 3 years, day in, day out, just to engage, you know, in self-exploration as well as pursuing intellectual inquiry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, how good was that? You know, so no, it was a wonderful time, really quite a significant occasion in my life, and it was also generally a very transformative experience. Mm. You know, at that stage in my life.
Right.
So yeah, so I finished that degree in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
After a year or so, I embarked on some practical work experience, for instance, working in a residential hostel for people with learning difficulties.
Mm.
I also worked for 6 months or so as an assistant psychologist, or psychology technician, as it used to be called in those days.
Yes.
And then I decided to embark on a two-year training course in social work, thinking that on paper it was similar to some of the clinical psychology courses I had been exploring.
Mm.
So I thought it was worth a shot, and I did that. So I trained in social work for 2 years, and I finished that training in around September 1989.
Mm.
And then I worked in the social work field on and off for about 3 years or so. I worked as a drug worker. I worked in an alcohol counseling service for a while. And I also worked as an HIV/AIDS social worker as well.
Did you find your psychology degree and your training and your immersion in the human condition and what makes relationships work in the psychology field, did that help you in those professions and those places that you found yourself?
Some of it was relevant to the work setting, but not all of it any means. So it was useful to have that background, that anchorage in psychology in order to work in these other areas. What I noticed, of course, was that with the start of the practical work, that led to the development of a whole new body of knowledge.
Mm.
So this was theory related very closely to practice rather than just pure theory in itself.
Well, I mean, what really comes across is your passion for psychology and the ideas and the explanations and the theories that come out of that, and that sort of gave you a sense of groundedness, and it sounds like you really enjoyed and immersed yourself in that process. I had an email from someone quite recently, obviously a mother of a 16-year-old boy. This is an Asian mother. He just passed his GCSEs and he wanted to take psychology at A-levels and obviously then move on to perhaps doing clinical psychology or whatever. And she was saying, as a parent, we are concerned that this is a very difficult profession to get into for an Asian person, especially in the UK. And we feel that non-Asians would not be comfortable coming to an Asian to discuss their problems, and that it's also hard to get jobs, and that their skin colour could be seen as a hindrance. I mean, I guess she's speaking from a sort of cultural context in terms of her own son, and wondering about that, and wondering about whether he's going to make it, you know, what prospects there are for him.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to be something that you had in your own sort of personal field when you were going into psychology. But is that a sort of general response from the Asian community about psychology?
It's interesting. I think certainly when I did my degree, there were very, very few students from Asian communities or other ethnic minority communities.
Yes.
And therefore even fewer members of staff. Over the last 30 years or so, what I've noticed is, particularly where I work here at the University of Westminster, and I suspect this applies to other metropolitan universities as well,
mm-hmm.
is that the number of students who are doing psychology has increased quite tremendously.
Right.
So in some departments, the representation of ethnic minorities can be as high as 50%.
Wow.
Possibly even more.
Right.
So this is a considerable increase from 30 years back. Of course, if you look at the more rural psychology departments, if you look at perhaps departments that are in the country, in the West Country, up north,
yes,
those kinds of locations, then I suspect the representation will still be quite low, and the students there will still be conspicuous by their small numbers.
Right.
Relating this to then prospects afterwards, so I don't think there are necessarily problems in this day and age in getting onto an undergraduate course to do psychology.
Yes.
But really the issue may be securing some sort of training afterwards, some professional training within psychology afterwards, whether it's in clinical psychology, educational psychology, occupational psychology, or whatever.
Right.
I suspect it's probably not as difficult as it used to be, because as the percentage of undergraduates taking the subject increases at the undergraduate level, then sooner or later I think those numbers will begin to be represented at the postgraduate, at the professional vocational levels. So I think things are gradually beginning to change. Of course, what it doesn't address is the more subtle issues around the subjective experience of a person from an Asian or an African Caribbean background once they are on such a course. So although you may have a numerical representation on a course, what you don't know is what their personal subjective experience will be like as a minority student.
Which is of course the subject of your research.
Absolutely.
Started to be a lecturer in psychology.
Yeah.
And then something drew you to research Black and ethnic minority students' experience being on the course. What first sort of drew you to that idea of looking at that?
It's a really interesting question, actually. When I did my psychology degree, only maybe about 2 years, 3 years after I graduated, I began to reflect on the nature of the psychology that I had been exposed to at university. For example, the psychology department is situated in the London Borough of Newham, which even in those days, 30 years ago, had a very sizable ethnic minority population. Mm-hmm. I think even in those days, approximately 33% of the population consisted of primarily Southeast Asians.
Yes.
Plus, of course, other groups of people. But I began to reflect on the fact that the psychology itself, in terms of the curriculum, had very little reference, if any, to some of these other cultures and cultural differences in behaviors and attitudes and differences in, for example, child rearing styles between different cultures, say the Asian cultures and the host culture, with respect to, for example, understandings of abnormality and pathology. Once again, there are interesting differences in how people from different cultures construe the meaning of illness, the meaning of madness.
Yes.
And I felt none of that was really covered on the course. And then, of course, I was also aware that the numerical representation of people from ethnic minorities was very, very low.
Yeah.
And so that in turn made me wonder what the experience must have been like for those people. I was blissfully unaware at the time about these issues, because I was just so immersed in the subject and this whole student experience. But it just made me wonder what might it have been like for these other students. How might they have felt about the lack of representation in the curriculum? What might have been the experience been like for them in terms of the social and personal environment of academia? So it was these various questions that led to writing a proposal for a PhD with a view towards exploring minority students' experience.
And of course you had students, you were teaching students, Asian and ethnic minority students, so were they giving you a sense of their experience being more challenging or less of a fit, I guess, is that kind of what you're saying with the teaching that was happening at the time?
Well, certainly by the time I embarked on the data collection for the PhD, which basically involved speaking to Black and Asian students from various psychology departments up and down the country, by the time I started talking to them about their experiences, I was just amazed at what they had to say. I mean, one of the things I was really amazed about was their sense of political awareness at that relatively young age, which I did not have myself. You know, my political awareness only began to grow afterwards. But talking to some of these students who were late in their late teens, early 20s, I was quite amazed by their awareness and their ability to articulate their dissatisfaction with their psychology degree, their dissatisfaction with their interactions with some of the other students, particularly the white students, as well as their interactions with white faculty. So some of the things they were coming out with, I thought, were amazing. You know, their ability to recognize common stereotypes expressed, for example, by white teaching staff about whether a particular Asian student was going to be married off as soon as they finished finished their degree, or whether they would, you know, be in an arranged marriage, and those kinds of things. So the stereotypes may have seemed quite benign on the surface, but clearly that they were not perceived to be as such by the actual students themselves. So what really struck me was that if I had not engaged in these conversations with these students, none of this would have come out. And the impression that would have been felt by perhaps other white students, by other white members of staff, would have been that everything's okay. That we are members of academia, we don't engage in any stereotypes or discrimination, prejudice or whatever. There are no problems here, but by virtue of talking to these people and getting them to express themselves in confidence, lots of interesting things started to come out. Including the students that I was teaching myself. I mean, none of them had actually come to me beforehand to say, Sanjay, you know, I'm having a problem here with this person, or I'm not enjoying the curriculum in relation to this topic. They certainly didn't approach me with any of those concerns. It's only by talking to them that they were able to express these kinds of concerns.
So you had to provide the space in order for the conversation to happen.
Absolutely. It was giving that space, giving them the permission to talk, and conveying the message that it was okay for them to express whatever concerns, whatever grievances they may have had, in a safe environment, in a confidential manner.
And you've indicated that the research has been sort of ongoing over time. Is it that you're continuing to talk to students as time goes on, or is that what's happening?
Certainly the main PhD research carried on for a number of years. The PhD itself was completed in 2003. And then something interesting happened, which was that in 2005, I was presenting some of my findings at the British Psychological Society conference that was taking place in Manchester.
Mm.
And some of my colleagues from the department were also presenting their findings. Their findings were focused on other minority students, such as gay students, lesbian students, and female students.
Right.
And what struck me was the similarity in the experiences of these various minority students.
Right.
My colleagues and I were quite struck about these similarities, so we decided to continue with this research further through a grant that we got from the Higher Education Academy. We came up with some very similar findings to the original PhD research.
Mm-hmm.
And then these findings also indicated the very complex and problematic nature of the experiences that minority students have of doing psychology. On the one hand, the vast majority of the students were enjoying the experience of studying psychology.
Yes.
But when looking at psychology from the viewpoint of, say, an Asian student or a black student or a gay or a lesbian student,
yes,
then they became aware of all sorts of difficulties, misrepresentations, non-representations.
Mm.
I think it's been a really interesting experience focusing on a whole variety of students who identify themselves through some minority status, if you like.
Yes.
You know, more recently, one of my colleagues, Ian Hodges, and I worked on a chapter together which has just come out in a book called Educational Diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And that chapter has actually focused on exploring the common architecture of the marginalized student experience.
Mm.
So that's been really, really interesting.
Right, so there's similar themes that come up in terms of how students experience themselves.
Yep, absolutely.
In the psychology training environment.
That's right.
Regardless of what minority they might be from.
Exactly.
And do you think that over the time that you've been looking at this area and talking to students, has there been a change in that perception or that experience? Or has that felt really constant in some way and you've just learned more about it?
It's interesting. I mean, the last time we collected data was a few years ago.
Yes.
So we've been collecting data on and off over the better part of the last 20 years. And certainly, you know, in that time, whatever data we have collected in the form of interviews, talking to these various students, the findings are essentially the same in terms of this marginalized experience. I certainly haven't spoken to students in the last few years.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to tell whether this subjective experience has started to undergo a change or not. It may well be that even the recent students are possibly going through the same dynamics as the students that we interviewed.
Given the themes that have surfaced, that you have, I guess, integrated, and maybe various other people who have been conducting the research have also integrated, has there been a change in terms of maybe what you do when you're presenting psychological ideas and concepts? Is there a change to how you approach a class of students and how you might support the minority students with their experience so that they don't feel quite so intense with it?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for example, we have a module called Psychology of Prejudice.
Right.
And so that serves as a perfect context in which to explore these kinds of issues further about the experience of prejudice, the experience of racism. Certainly the first lecture that I do for the Psychology of Prejudice module usually has quite a substantial coverage on the emergence of the ideology of racism in society more generally and its later infusion, if you like, within academia and particularly in psychology.
Yes, yeah.
So we certainly are able to address those kinds of issues very, very formally in the teaching context and also in other subjects which may not be explicitly related to issues of prejudice or whatever, I still try and incorporate examples that refer to prejudice and, you know, the feelings of being in a minority. A few years ago, we used to run an IT skills module, and one of the things we used to get students to explore was searching for psychology-related articles.
Right.
So one example that I always used to give was for them to search articles on prejudice.
Okay.
So that, from that early stage,
in
the first semester of their first year, it gave them exposure to this particular area.
Because I guess you're talking about the shadow part of psychology, with a, I guess it has a particular history, which sometimes does have prejudice and sometimes discriminate against certain groups. While there's this part where, which is curious and gives a sense of meaning and understanding to the world of relationships, there's also the shadow part, which I guess you're talking about, which every institution has, which is used to marginalise and to discriminate with as well. So I guess that's the area that you're talking about, and the module in particular around discrimination talks into.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think the psychology of prejudice module was born out of a personal and a professional interest that was expressed by certain members of staff in the department. It was actually originally set up by somebody called David Milner, who has now retired, but he did a lot of work in this area, particularly looking at those black doll studies and the perceptions of preferences for black or white dolls amongst children. So he did a lot of work in that area, as well as stuff around intergroup relations. And also, I think the module, as you said, reflects this shadow side of psychology. I mean, certainly psychology during the early part of its scientific history was very blatantly racist in terms of the kinds of things it got up to. You know, there were psychologists who made very explicitly racist comments about different groups of people. So Sir Francis Galton, for example, in talking about the differential IQ abilities of so-called Negroes and whites, you had various other people around the beginning of the 20th century, which obviously influenced their research agendas. And then, of course, you've got the more extreme examples of what some psychologists did places like Nazi Germany, apartheid South Africa.
Sure.
There you've got really extreme examples of psychologists putting their tools to rather unappetizing explorations. Which very explicitly, I think, serve to dehumanize certain groups of people. Although psychology is not quite as explicitly racist as it used to be, there is still a lot of underlying subtle covert prejudice and racism that I suspect still simmers away.
Yes,
because at the end of the day, psychology is defined by the people who work as psychologists. Not every single psychologist is free of racism or prejudice. So either knowingly, or I suspect often unknowingly, that prejudice must come out through their research, through their work, through their teaching. So I think these kinds of modules, like the psychology of prejudice, hopefully serve to redress the balance,
yes.
And then also to give space to explore how these kinds of issues have shaped the discipline that we are part of, today.
Because the mother that I talked about who emailed me is clearly coming from that place, of the shadow place,
right,
from psychology. And perhaps thinking her son's going to have a hard time with the shadow of psychology. But
right.
And it's important to name and to address that this exists,
yeah,
for students, for both black and white and Asian students, to free them for dialogue around it, because yeah. Then there's going to be some hope for change at that point.
Yeah.
But I guess when you started, that was the shadow wasn't really talked about in that way.
I think when I started, it certainly wasn't. Just to put things in context, I mean, yeah. I think that there have been, you know, a number of changes over the last maybe 10, 15 years. I mean, for example, the BPS, the British Psychological Society,
mm-hmm.
I think that has really started to, I think, take on board some of these issues around diversity, around equality, around a more representative curriculum and so on.
Sure,
and
yeah.
The BPS has actually brought out a number of very useful publications over the last maybe 7-8 years or so.
Okay.
So you know, that's been very encouraging.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think there have been other initiatives by, for example, the HEA, the Higher Education Academy, which I don't think exists anymore, unfortunately, but has also, over the last maybe 10, 12 years, done quite a lot in encouraging research around this area. So I would probably say to this mother that their child would probably have a pleasant, positive experience of doing psychology.
Yes. Certainly sounds like there's a lot going on, as the research that you're doing and your colleagues, obviously, and other psychological agencies as well.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's lots of changes and lots of things going on.
There are.
It's very encouraging, yeah.
It is encouraging. Yeah. I suspect, psychology probably recognises that it's necessary for it to change. Otherwise, it'll just be, I think, left behind.
Yes, yes.
You know? Whatever the motives are, it's definitely changing.
Yeah. Oh, great. You did talk about your book. Do you want to say more about it?
Yes, basically it's a chapter in a book. The chapter is called Mapping Exclusion in Undergraduate Psychology Towards a Common Architecture of the Minority Student Experience. And this is a chapter that one of my colleagues, Ian Hodges, and I co-wrote, and that's appearing in a book called Educational Diversity.
Right.
So it has literally just come out.
Oh, right. Okay.
So if anybody's interested in pursuing this area of research further, then I think that chapter is a good place to start.
Yes. Well, I'll have that link on the website, so if people want to get the book and find out a bit more, then they can do that.
Yeah.
And to find out more about your research and some of the things the students were saying, and I mean, where would people go for that?
They can certainly either get in touch with me directly, or they can look at information on the University of Westminster website.
Right.
That's got some links. There is some information under my profile on the University of Westminster page.
Right, okay. Yeah. So people can link on to some of the things that you've been writing about there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, great. It's been really, really great to speak with you, Sanjay.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, so thanks.
You're very welcome.
That was Sanjay Jobanputra talking about his journey to becoming a psychologist and about his research into black and ethnic minority students' experiences studying psychology, and how that research has affected some psychology trainings. If you would like to comment on this podcast or any of the other podcasts, you can email me at podcast@baatn.org.uk, or you can leave your thoughts on the Barton podcast page by going to www.baatn.org.uk/podcast, where you can also find more information about Sanjay's writings and research. I hope you can join me for the next podcast, when I'll be talking with Poppy Banerjee, who will be talking about Asian women and domestic abuse. Until then, goodbye.